Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Gail Seiler, together with Loris Olson. Hello, Loris.
Hello, Gail. And I think the snow is pretty today. I just want to get that out of the way early, okay?
I agree. I'm a snow fan, and we finally had our first big snowfall this weekend. I know people are out shoveling, and it's hard work, and driving is tough, but I still love snow, and I enjoy being out in it.
What did you do out in the snow this weekend?
So I shoveled a lot, and I actually went snowshoeing near my home yesterday. And one thing I noticed during that time when I was out were the tracks of animals all through the snow. It's always fun to see people staying indoors, but animals just carrying on and doing their thing. A big snowstorm doesn't keep wildlife indoors, of course.
No, it doesn't. And I found that out when I lived in Alaska and when I lived in Wisconsin, but also here. So to start the show today, we're going to listen to a wildlife segment prepared for us by Pat Schlarbaum, and it's about otters.
Who love the snow.
Today's focus on phenology is about Iowa's river otters. Be watching for their tracks and slides in the snow. River otters are the one critter in all creation that seems to have fun all the time. Otters enjoy everything in life, and they are once again present for all Iowans to enjoy. From their lope across land, humping along like a fur-covered slinky toy, to their movements through water, undulating with sleek, porpoising motions, otters move through life with amazing grace. Otters have always been a highly desirable and coveted mammal. They are extremely shy and elusive of humans. With the snow and freezing conditions, it's that time of year. Their familiar dot-dash-dot pattern of hopping and sliding and hopping and then sliding and then hopping along the ice and leaving their tracks and slides through the snow. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis of Lewis and Clark fame wrote about his first encounter with otters. "The color is a uniform dark brown, and when in good order and good season, perfectly black and glossy. It is the richest, and I think the most delicious, fur in the world. At least I cannot form an idea of any more so. It is deep, thick, silky in the extreme, and strong. The inner part of the fur, when open, is lighter than the surface in its natural position. There are some fine black and shining hairs intermixed with the fur, which are rather longer and add much to its beauty." Meriwether Lewis on River Otters. As Iowa was settled by the pioneers, river otters were removed by overexploitation and habitat loss. The last river otter in Iowa was in Woodbury County along the Missouri River in 1929. Ironically, this was near the site that Meriwether described the first otter that he had seen on their voyage of discovery. Over the decades, there were a few otters noted along the Mississippi River in northeast Iowa that were entangled in fishing nets. However, river otters did not pioneer or move on their own into suitable habitat like other rejuvenated species like bald eagles or bobcats. It seemed that areas that had river otters historically would never have otters again. Then things changed for the better in 1985. A trade was made to bring river otters to Iowa from an otter-rich area in Louisiana. 32 Iowa wild turkeys were sent to Kentucky that obtained 16 river otters from Louisiana to send to Iowa. The otters were placed in the backwaters of Red Rock Reservoir south of Des Moines. They survived their first winter admirably, and it can be noted that the same genetic makeup of the fur that keeps an Iowa otter warm in winter will keep the Louisiana otters cool in the summer. Over the next decade or so, 220 river otters were brought to Iowa and released in the ratio of 10 males and 10 females at 12 sites around the state. From those efforts, river otters have now rejuvenated the waters in all 99 of Iowa counties. Otters have been noted along the Des Moines River in central Iowa. In the 1990s, otters were placed in the Chautauqua area of Polk County, downstream from Ames, on the Skunk River. From those placements, river otters have been noted at McFarland Lake and Peterson Pits in north-central Story County. Recently, in a southern Iowa woodland, a river otter passed right through the trees for all the world to see. I was being pretty quiet, and it took my breath away. It took 30 years, but I got to see an otter where I grew up near Garden Grove between the Weldon and the Jonathan Rivers. I'd read that otters can go overland, away from water, and this was a prime example. And wow, it was the blackest otter I've ever seen. I'd been working on this phenology, and then to see one flowing through the trees, well, sometimes in life you can't make this stuff up. Unlike other mammals that hibernate or take long sleep cycles in winter, river otters remain very active. Their familiar dot-dash-dot pattern of hopping, and sliding through the snow and leaving their tracks are a joy to discover, and it's a joy to realize that the highly cherished river otters are with us once again. We're pretty sure Meriwether Lewis would get a kick out of that. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with a phonology for today.
Thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for that interesting piece on otters, and it fit the weather very, very well.
It did.
Now we're going to turn our attention to 4-H, which is a familiar organization to many people here in Iowa. Many of all ages know about 4-H and have been involved in various ways. 4-H is the nation's largest youth development and youth mentoring organization. Millions of young people each year across the country participate in 4-H. People may not realize that 4-H is associated with the Cooperative Extension System, and therefore it's linked with land-grant universities like ISU. To learn more about 4-H, I was looking at the website of the national organization, and one thing that it said was, 4-H reaches every corner of our nation, from urban neighborhoods to suburban schoolyards to rural farming communities. I was kind of surprised by that statement. I guess I think of 4-H as being primarily in rural farming communities and schools. But it seems 4-H serves a much wider range of communities, and that is what we're going to be talking about today. And so we are very happy to have John Paul Chasson Cardenas with us. He is the state 4-H Youth Development Program Leader. Hello, John Paul.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good, and you had quite a drive up from Des Moines to get here, you were telling us.
I did. It's one of those snowy, snowy days, and it took me about an hour and a half. So.
Oh, my. Well, thank you very much for being here and for making that effort.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And I'm sure we'll learn a lot from you. So your position comes out of Cooperative Extension at ISU, and you recently took over that position. Is that right?
I did. I've been about 5 months in the position, so.
Can you tell us about your background and the kinds of experiences that you bring to 4-H here?
You know, I'm probably not one of those traditional 4-Hers. Mm-hmm. I have the honor and pleasure of knowing for 4-H for a long time. For example, I was in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where 4-H was really about horses. But originally, I'm from Guatemala, Central America. My first language is not English. And when I immigrated to the United States, 4-H was not in my lexicon. However, in my family in California, especially my wife's family, 4-H is a long tradition. As a matter of fact, my young nephew just won third place at his fair for a wonderful rooster he's been raising for a long time.
Congratulations to him.
Yeah. Yes, he's wonderful.
That's exciting. That's an interesting trajectory that's brought you to 4-H. What would you say is the mission of 4-H?
Well, the mission of 4-H is not the one that most people think about 4-H, and they think about farms, about animals and so forth, but really it's about connecting youth with adults who care for them and also connect them to the technology that's out there. So that's really what 4-H is. It's a conduit for early adopters. If you look at the history of 4-H, actually, it's one and all with innovation. For example, when the land-grant mission, which, you know, Iowa State is one of the land-grant colleges or the University of the People, was created, around the time where agriculture was the major technology in our state, they couldn't access, they couldn't get a hold or work with the adults. So they created 4-H to be able to connect technology to the youth and therefore have better early adopters, which then took it to their parents. I really do credit 4-H and Iowa State Extension for making Iowa the breadbasket of the world. And 4-H is an Iowa invention, by the way.
I wasn't aware of that. As a native Iowan and a longtime person, attendee at the Iowa State Fair, I, of course, go to the 4-H building every year and always am amazed at the displays, the amount of work that the students put into them, the amount of variety from the traditional farm, because I grew up in North Iowa, and so there were farms in North Iowa. I wasn't a farm kid, but definitely I had uncles and aunts who had farms. But all the high-tech type of displays and the work that the students do. I'm very impressed.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, we really run the gamut from corn to animals to working with humane shelters and also on the other side we have technology, everything from Legos to coding, et cetera, because it's really about connecting youth to technology and really putting them with adults who really care for them.
Early adopters of technology is not a phrase I would have associated with the 4-H.
Well, it is. So that, yeah. And it used to be. I mean, think of your cell phone. You know, you probably have somebody in your life right now who runs that little machine better than you do, and they're probably under the age of 10. So it's just technology of change. At that time, it was agriculture, and it continues to be in Iowa. But agriculture is not the same business it used to be. And, for example, if you don't know GPS, agriculture becomes very difficult in this time and age.
That highlight something that is interesting to me. As most people know, the demographics of Iowa are changing now, and many immigrant populations are increasing. The Latino population is increasing, as well as people from countries in Southeast Asia and Africa. According to the 2010 census, racial and ethnic minorities make up over 11% of people in Iowa, and in the younger age groups, that percentage is even higher. So can you talk a bit about that? How do you feel 4-H is doing in reaching out to students from these diverse racial and ethnic groups?
We're starting to. And that's part of the reason I think I got brought on. One in five kids in Iowa now is a kid of color. And so it is changing meaningfully, but it's also changing meaningfully in other ways. 52% of kids in the state of Iowa are now in 10 counties, 10 urban counties. So we need to adapt. And that's what we were starting to do. 4-H, again, is a whole gamut. So doing things like working with technology within the cities, making it accessible for kids of color in communities is just as important as making sure those kids in isolated rural communities are engaged with the program, and that's what we're working. And the one vision that I brought on board when I came to 4-H was simply make it for everybody, and that means making sure that every child in Iowa has an opportunity to be engaged with 4-H.
Is it more difficult to recruit students from urban areas or students who don't live on farms than students who already live in farming areas who kind of already know about 4-H?
You know, it's not hard to recruit the students. What has been a little bit harder is to kind of break the mold of what people think 4-H is. So there's this general idea, this general stereotype, and it's based on truth. We have a long history and a noble history in agriculture. However, 4-H is much more than that. 4-H really runs the gamut of four different areas. One is citizenship and leadership, arts and communications, also STEM, which is a big part of what we're doing in Iowa. And in addition to that, it's healthy living. So it's much broader than most people think of what it is.
I'd like to just clarify for the audience, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math.
Sorry about that.
That's
yes, you're
okay.
Absolutely
those acronyms.
Right. Yes, I get carried away. But we make sure that we carry the arts, too. So, you know, we are really about starting from where the youth are and then help them move forward, whatever their interest is. That's really our hallmark is positive youth development.
I was wondering, following up on the question of as we get more and more population, diverse population, are you able to recruit leaders that can connect with those students, the youth of color?
Well, that's one of the things that we're enhancing is our volunteer corps. And so we are investing quite heavily in making sure we do volunteer recruitment and do it in a different way. We're also looking at a whole series of new programs that support the youth that traditionally would not be the youth that we think about farm, but do connect them back to where food comes from, et cetera. And so things like we have some accelerators to get kids or Latino youth, for example, who don't speak English, or Latino youth who may be immigrants, or Latino youth who just may be in urban areas or even in rural areas engaged with our work. This, for me, is something that's part and parcel. I was an immigrant to the United States. I didn't come until late high school. I didn't learn English until late high school. So having the opportunity to be part of this effort is just coming back home for me, and it's really an honor and pleasure. But the other thing that I really understand that, for example, those youth of color, those Latino youth, are not that different from our youth that we see every day in 4-H. For example, when I ask youth, you know, what is something that's important to do? What do you value? The first two answers are always, I value my family. When I talk to Latino youth, Family is very important. They say I value hard work. Iowa youth say that. And Latino youth say that. And the other thing that people don't realize about corn, don't forget that us, people from Guatemala, actually gave you corn, coffee, and chocolate. So we may all be Latinos, but don't know it yet.
Thank you very much for all three.
And for pointing that out to us. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, building community through communication. We're talking with Jean-Paul Chesson-Cardenas, the State 4-H Youth Development Program Leader. He's here with us in the studio, and we're talking about his vision for 4-H, which is much broader than people might expect. Building on some of the things you just were talking about, I know 4-H is involved in a lot of different things. There's clubs in schools, there's after-school programs, there's summer programs, there's even camps. Can you tell us a bit about how you see those kind of tapping into the diverse youth that are now in Iowa?
Absolutely. And you can just call me Jean-Paul, actually. Nobody knows my last name, period, around the state. So Jean-Paul is great. We actually do whatever the youth are really interested in. So that allows us to do either use the 4-H camp up by Madrid and have camping, but also retreats, you know, having retreats that allow youth to be able to be there and separate themselves out a little bit from the daily bustle and continue to do work in STEM or whatever else they want to do. But in addition to that, we also have after-school programs. We have in-school programs. This is a major initiative for us, is to work and align with school districts to make sure that the work that's happening in 4-H actually helps the academic performance of youth, not by doing the same things, but making sure that kids are able to get dirty, play with things, break things, open up things, and make sure that, you know, I'm talking about technology. The best way to learn technology is really hands-on, and our work is really hands-on.
By that theory, as many technological devices as I've broken, I should be an expert, but I'm not sure that's right.
Well, the other part is assembling them, so and that's the one we always work. But you have to try and break things, get dirty in order to make it work.
And for youth for whom English is not their first language, are there ways in which they can be involved in 4-H and it may facilitate them using both languages?
Well, one of the things that we know is that there's something called the acquisition filter. That means mm-hmm. that if you're able to kind of lose your inhibitions, it helps you learn English much faster. But also, ahora estamos comenzando a hablar en español. Entonces, we're able to start adapting to the realities and context that we're doing.
So that's a wonderful way for them to learn and practice
and learn leadership. And yeah. I mean, learn leadership. We think a lot of times a citizen as a set of papers, but the reality is how do you give back to your community? And 4-H being a leadership program, it's really about how do you give back to your communities. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that our communities, in communities of color, have a propensity to give back. And so we are really in a wonderful place right now. The other thing is that some of the narratives in Iowa sometimes, especially as you get the older adults in Iowa, we have a narrative that's really entrenched in things like the farm crisis. So we talk a lot about loss in Iowa. But if we look at the new communities, a lot of those communities are coming here because this is a great place to live. There's a good place for families, and the narrative's actually one of opportunity. It's something that we're learning every day. And an example of that is my family. My family, when I moved here, then my parents followed with my sister. My sister met this wonderful Iowa boy and got married, you know. Now she's a senior attorney at Principal. Then I met this wonderful woman in the Bay Area, and she moved to Iowa, too. She calls that true love right around now in the middle of the winter. And then her sister came and their children, and then her brother came. And, you know, it just continues to be. So I think half of the new Iowans actually is my family. So
we're not all that bad.
No, I think Iowa has a long history of being open to new folks and also mm-hmm. a long history of giving back and service. I think there's a nobility to Iowans, and I think there's a kindness that you do not find everywhere else. As a matter of fact, my wife and I traveled the world, and when we decided to settle with a wonderful, you know, 8-year-old daughter that I have now, the place that we chose was Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad to have you here. One thing I was thinking when you were talking about the students or youth for whom English is not their first language, or whether they're from Spanish-speaking countries or other countries, working with the youth who for whom English is their first language and maybe are recent native Iowans.
Correct.
I think it's important for in terms of breaking down stereotypes, too, because the non-minority youth may have stereotypes that may not be overcome just by interacting with students in school, because we know that in school, groups tend to break apart. So if they can work together on things, they say that that is one of the best ways to break down stereotypes. To work together with people who are different than you toward a common goal. And there actually is research that supports that.
I agree. And that's why having things like Lego robotics or having them do projects that are very hands-on is really important. But something we should know is that our youth are actually better at inclusion than we mm-hmm. are. And so one of the things that I learn every day when I meet with our state council and meet with youth is I learn from them, even though I'm supposed to be the mm-hmm. expert around this area. The reality is that they are fantastic, and every day they teach us. And so one of the things that I always say is we're learning from a youth just as much as they're learning from us.
Do the youth help you do your programming also? Do they often bring forth the new ideas, the new areas?
Yes, that's one of the things that I try to do is spend a lot of time with youth. I've actually, since I took tenure, I probably have met with folks from every corner of the state. I've zigzagged. I've gone from Postville to Scotts Bluff and from Sioux City to Davenport. And so quite literally, I've been trying to hit all 99 counties. And if I haven't hit all 99 counties, I've actually met people from all 99 counties. And so it's really wonderful. And I make a special time to meet with folks like our youth council. We have a wonderful state youth council with about 40 to 50 youth. And we this year included a whole set of youth who are diverse who service an advisory council to them. And they're planning a state conference. And so we listen very carefully to what they want, because ultimately these programs are for them. And if they're not leading him, then we're not doing our work.
We recently had a local talk show that was on immigrants who are in the U.S. without proper documentation mm-hmm. or they've gotten DACA status.
Is DACA being?
Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivers. Mm-hmm. Can students without proper documentation be involved in 4-H?
We're not an immigration agency, so every student is welcome to be in 4-H. And one of the things that people don't know about Iowa youth is that we actually have not as many immigrant units we think. Most of the youth who are here, who might be Latino and so forth, are actually native-born. Therefore, mm-hmm. they're citizens by birth. We only have something like 6,000 immigrants in our schools, so it's actually quite a small number. Now, the biggest barrier you find sometimes is language, and so we're working very hard to build the capacity in that area to make sure that we're serving youth in their native language, because we know if we support the native language, then we're able to also support the learn of English. And so, and you know, you think about it. If you learn the quadratic equation in English, Chinese, or Spanish, it doesn't matter. You still learn the quadratic equation, so it still helps out in your long-term prospects in school.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about 4-H or things you have coming up?
Well, I need your help. I mean, I really want to get a hold of those folks. We are an organization that heavily depends on our volunteers. We have one of the largest volunteer corps in the state. And now we're trying to reach audiences who are different than what traditionally have been our audiences. So we've depended for many years on those 2, 3, 4 generation 4-Hers to help us out and those families that have been long involved. But now we're also looking for a whole new core of volunteers. And for those of you who really like working with kids, you know, this is a wonderful opportunity to really make a difference, a solid difference. And we can do anything. I don't care if you like photography or like radio. We can find youth that like also doing that, and we'll partner you up with them. The other thing I would say is that it will increase the well-being of your life. It will make you happier to engage with youth. I guarantee that, and every day it makes me younger. I'm actually aging in reverse because I have this job.
Well, you definitely talk about them being our future and the opportunity and being positive. So I need to spend more time with them, yes.
They're not our future, though. They're today.
Okay,
they're here.
Thank you.
They are today, so.
Well, thank you very much. And anyone out there who's interested and wants to take up this enthusiasm that John Paul has for working with youth, they should get in touch with 4-H.
Thank you for having me.
Their local chapter or
And you have a website, correct?
We do. Just if you go to 4-H Iowa, you will find us. I mean, we're 1, 2, 3, and 6, and 7, and 8. So keep on going on the list. So you'll find something that really calls to you. And from there, you can just sign up on our website. And if you want to be a volunteer or if you want to participate, we will triage you to the right people across our state. We're in every county. We actually have 100 offices, not 99. Mm-hmm. We're doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. We're looking forward to working with you.
Well, thank you very much. You've certainly given us a lot to think about in terms of the important role that 4-H can play for our youth. And thank you again for driving here today. And safe travels the rest of the day.
It might be cold out there, but it's warm in here.
All right.
Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a man, he came from my hometown. He wore his passion for his woman like a thorny crown. He said, Dolores, I live in fear. My love for you is so overpowering, I'm afraid that I will disappear. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a woman became a wife. These are the very words she uses to describe her life. She said a good day ain't got no rain. She said a bad day's when I lie in bed and think of things that might have been. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. And I know a father who had a son. He longed to tell him all the reasons for the things he'd done. He came a long way just to explain. He kissed his boy as he lay sleeping, then he turned around and headed home again. He slipped sliding, slipped sliding away. You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding. God only knows, God makes his plan. The information's unavailable to the mortal man.
That was Slip Sliding Away by Paul Simon. We thought that would be appropriate for folks driving out there and try to get you sliding along in a positive direction and not crashing into other people.
And now you know a lot about Gail's sense of humor because she picked it out. You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Most of us don't associate architecture with humanitarian efforts, yet a building designed without serious consideration of the people who use it is rarely seen as nurturing the human spirit, let alone making daily life as easy and as productive as possible. Our next guest, Arvid Osterberg, has spent much of his professional career melding building design and human needs. 2 weeks ago, he was named an Ames Humanitarian for his dedication to an architectural concept called inclusive design. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
We will be discussing Professor Osterberg's work, although he says call him Arvid, so, in a minute. But first, here's a bit of background about the award he has just won. The Ames Humanitarian Award is given by the Ames Human Relations Commission. The award recognizes someone whose contributions promote diversity, fairness, and equality in the community. However, it is not a yearly event. The commission went several years without choosing an award winner before naming the 2012 recipient. Nor are there any preconceived boundaries about which contributions meet the criteria. For example, Deborah Lee won in 2012 for her grassroots efforts in engaging community members in conversations to overcome racial tensions. Last year, Raleigh Link, a retired Ames police officer, won the award for learning Spanish to better communicate with a growing Spanish-speaking population in Ames. And this year, Arvid Osterberg has won the award for his commitment to the architectural concept called inclusive design. Dr. Osterberg, Arvid, could you please tell us what is inclusive design?
Well, thank you, Loris, and thank you, Gail, and I appreciate being here this morning. And it's a great privilege for me to have received this award. You know, inclusive design really goes beyond architecture. It really involves a lot of things, and I think the more I've thought about it, the more inclusive it really gets. But let's talk about architecture for a moment. You know, it started off sort of as, how do we eliminate barriers for people with disabilities? You know, the movement, I guess my first thoughts about it go back to when I was in college, and they were putting these wood ramps on the back doors of entrances to buildings. And I remember going to class with another student, fellow student who used a wheelchair, and, you know, he went in the back door with the wooden ramp. I went in the front door up the steps. He got to use the elevator because he had a key, and I couldn't. So if I wanted to go to those upper floors and I had a problem with my legs or muscles or something, I just had to go up the stairs. So in a way, we had discrimination both ways. We had discrimination for and against. And the movement's taken a long time to really kind of come around to this point. And in fact, there's two terms kind of in common use now. There's the universal design idea, and then there's inclusive design. There was a colleague of mine who had had polio and had been paralyzed and became an architect, and he did really well. He did a lot of nice things to promote this idea, and along about the 1980s, he came up with this concept of universal design. The idea of universal design is a design that works for everybody. So you could come up with one design that really, in a way, included everybody. A bit later, the British and some others came up with the idea of inclusive design. Now, inclusive design is really based on the idea that you don't discriminate against people or groups of people based on the design. So if we go back to that example, you know, we would have a grade level entrance at both the front and the back. The elevator would be public and would be usable for everybody. And you're not trying to eliminate people through the design. If you think about universal design, it's kind of an ideal concept, a design that would work for everybody. But we know designs can't always work for everybody.
Because each of us are very unique individuals.
Yeah, that's right. And some people are very tall, some are very wide. There are all sorts of different needs on the spectrum. And so if we try to make a universal design doorway, you know, how big does that doorway need to be? Really, the best universal design doorway is no doorway or no door.
With inclusive design, how does that differ from the universal when it comes to no doorway?
Well, I don't know. I think those two terms are still being used quite a bit. And this is one reason I wanted to bring it up is there doesn't seem to be a wide agreement on which of these terms is going to be the one of choice. But to me, as I've thought about it more and more, I like the idea of inclusive design because it connotates, rather than the ideal of something working for everybody, it connotates more the idea of we don't leave people out, we don't leave groups out, we try to design for as many people as possible without the need for specialized adaptation or design.
And how does that work versus what we think of as the standard model for architecture?
I think architecture is a very comprehensive and difficult field. Some of the best architects were in their 90s when they did their best work. It really is a very difficult challenge to do everything. And so as an educator, I'm trying to make this part of the students' experience and raise their awareness about it. And the last few years, I've noticed a lot better interest on the part of the students, and they seem to be buying into the concept much more than previously. I guess it's just something that interested me a long time ago, and so when I became passionate about it and started studying it, you know, I just naturally tried to include it as part of of part of my teaching.
But you also do design work along with teaching architecture at Iowa State, correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just we should make that clear. So as I was doing some research, I came across much information that said inclusive design really incorporates the user, the end user in. Can you explain how the user is brought into the process?
Well, we did a really comprehensive study of the university campus some years ago to look at all of these issues. What complied with the Americans with Disabilities Act and what didn't? And we really got a lot of good ideas from people with disabilities. We involved people with disabilities. We consciously sought them out. We had students working for us. We paid them by the hour. We had faculty and staff that volunteered their time. And it was a wide gamut of users. So I think the thing to do is to get involved a number of different kinds of users. We had some people with some hearing problems. We had some people with some vision difficulties. And the range, from partially sighted to blind. We had wheelchair users. We had people with artificial legs, or at that time, they didn't have nearly as good as prosthetics as they do now. And we walked around campus with them and followed them around and sort of studied what is it that gives you difficulty and how might these things be designed better. So it really ranged the gamut from parking, accessible route, the experience you have from the parking itself to the entrance of the building. As you go in the building, what's the experience about? Maybe even finding your way, because some building environments, as you know, are very confusing. Hospitals, for example.
And as I was reading, I found with visual, color is important, correct?
Yes.
Can you explain how we might incorporate color into inclusive?
For example, most blind people have some vision. They're not in total darkness. And so this is really good in terms of how the designer, if they're thinking about this, can respond. So the designer can have good contrast between the floors and the wall, for example, so that as you're walking down a corridor, you can clearly see that distinction. Now, along with this goes lighting and window placement and other considerations. Glare is often a problem. So since the majority of blind people have some vision, this is a good thing for designers because they can do design environments that are more responsive, that work better for all of those partially sighted people. And, of course, with the elderly, there are a lot of people with vision problems and vision losses. And as we get older, we all experience losses in our senses. And so the designer, if they're aware of this, if designers are aware of this, they can respond appropriately.
And that's why the focus groups or the user groups are so important up front then.
Yes, yes, very important.
Okay.
And inclusive design can be used in kind of institutional buildings, which is what you've been talking about, but also in homes and in thinking about people's living spaces. Is that right?
Definitely. And, we all need to look at our own homes, and I think we make some very common mistakes in our own environments. But things like handrails on stairways, just the habits that we're in of where we put things and tripping over things inside the home. So I think the concept really goes beyond just the design of the physical environment or the architectural design.
In fact, we're going to bring another voice into the conversation in just a moment. But first, I want to remind everyone, if you're just joining us, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host, Laura Solson, and with us is also our co-host, Gail Seiler. We are speaking with ISU Professor of Architecture, Arvid Osterberg, who has been chosen as the 2015 Ames Humanitarian for using the concept of inclusive design in his own work and promoting the concept to the next generation of architects. We're going to bring in the voice of Ames resident Shelley Jaspering now. She's partially paralyzed and has used a wheelchair full-time for almost 10 years. Her new home, one half of a new duplex on Duff Avenue, was built using inclusive design principles. but her appreciation of inclusive design, which she calls universal design, extends beyond her own circumstances.
It was set up for all my needs. It's fantastic. I went through the design with the architect, and every little detail we thought about throughout the whole process. And my parents were there every day, and my dad wired it. So he said he got me in there whenever we could, and we measured for accessibility because there's ADA standards on how to place things. And as we went through the process, we learned not all ADA is perfect. It's helpful to learn about all different types of needs and these situations because, yeah, you don't always think about it until it's something that you or someone you know needs. So setting up something for, like, universal design is, I think it's huge. And when my parents have thought about it now because they built their house they moved in about 6 months before my accident. And if they would have built it 6 months later, they would have done a lot of things differently. And they're getting older. And as they see their friends modify their houses and things or just redo their houses, they don't see them doing modifications a lot of the times. And you know, they try to describe to them, well, you might have problems being able to get into your shower, being able to see all the things because my grandma has macular degeneration, so I definitely understand the not being able to see stuff to a point. So it's good to keep those things in mind when you are building or modifying something, because everyone gets older and it might help the next person even if you do plan on moving.
The duplex she was referring to was built for Shelley Jaspering and Jason, the owner of the other half, who also uses a wheelchair, and it was built by Habitat for Humanity of Central Iowa. While both had some accessibility features where they had been living previously, their new homes were built to allow them as much independence as possible.
Well, Jason lived in an apartment, and it was set up for him. He lived there over 15 years, and it was basic accessibility. He had carpet to roll over. Place I was living in, my parents helped me with, and so did do some accommodations. We took out the carpet. The shower was very small. The kitchen, a lot of the storage was up high, so I just made do with what I could reach, and I had a lot of help. My laundry was in the basement. Their architects worked with me and Jason, and they made a plan, and then we modified it as needed. For me, since I'm able to use my hands, I wanted to have everything for me to be able to roll under, get as close to as possible. So I have a cooktop that I roll under, a sink in the kitchen that is very shallow. My oven is side swinging that I can roll up to. We even put a platform so I can take items out of the oven and set them on there safely because of my balance. Anything that's easy for a normal person to take out of the oven, I might flop and burn myself and not realize. So details like that were really important. I looked a lot online, and we looked at a lot of books and discussed with anybody that's done anything like this for ideas. And there's a good online community to find ideas, which is helpful. I put a lot of thought into the new house where I wanted to do my own laundry. I wanted to be able to do my own dishes. Nobody likes cleaning, but as much as I can do for myself is good. I do get assistance, but the more I can do for myself, the better. We did discuss with the local professor as his ideas, and he gave some input and said that the flow looked really great.
Doctor, you heard we did discuss with the professor. You gave some input on the design for Shelley's house, correct?
Yes. I never met with her directly, but I had a number of conversations with her father and some emails back and forth, and I suggested some references for them to look at so they could be a little better acquainted with, you know, what materials were out there to help them in this process.
Now, the next clip we're going to hear actually in a way relates to the advice or the input that you gave to them, because Shelley was on a very tight budget, and inclusive design can sometimes cost extra, correct?
Correct.
So let's go ahead and listen to this clip, because Habitat for Humanity does restrict the maximum amount it will spend to build homes. And let's listen to Shelley talk about how she had to budget for inclusive items.
I, in general, try to discuss with the building people, the business owners in the city of Ames, and people try to work with me. One of my favorite places to go is actually up several stairs, and I used to get carried up them, and now I have a device that I can take over there. But that's only if I'm going to be there for several hours. It's not worth it to just pop in to a place like that.
Okay, that was the wrong clip. We're on audio 3, but just to recap what Shelley talks about in that clip, is she talked about that they had to go for durability because they had the showers were of great concern to them, and some of the other features, they had to spend some of their money and still keep within budget for inclusivity. When you work with a project, is there how much does it add to the cost?
Well, you know, this is a question that gets a little bit hard to answer. I think in this particular case, you have someone that has needs that go beyond what can normally be provided in a housing environment. So there are going to be some extra expenses. But so many things can be built in without extra charge. And so there's a concept that's being promoted that's called visitability. And this is to have a certain number of housing units or a certain portion of housing units that are built that just have some common sense things like a no-step entrance. If all the new houses being built, duplexes and so on, had no-step entrances, this would resolve a lot of problems. And if it's done correctly, it really doesn't need to cost more money. You can have wider doorways throughout. You can have maneuverability, space to maneuver around. Typically, these kinds of things do not cost extra money. When it comes to special adaptations in a kitchen or bathroom, sometimes there is some extra charge involved for those kinds of things to suit particular needs. So I think the idea would be have better designs throughout for all new housing environments. And then for certain individuals like this one, there are going to be some other cost considerations. And that's a real challenge for the designer. How can you do it with minimal extra expense?
Okay. Accessibility is also an issue for Shelley as a local small business owner. She sells handmade items in her shop where it's at, which is at the Town Center building on Main Street in Ames. Let's listen to her talk about accessibility problems with the Town Center.
Well, initially I was on the main floor and I had a small spot and there was actually no accessible, there was no restroom on the main floor. So I limited my hours and I figured out ways around that. And then when I moved down to the basement because I realized there was a ramp in the back of the building and I park in the back now. So that actually works better. It's just harder for people to find me. So with signage, it takes a lot to get somebody to find my business for sure. But I can get in. There is a little bit of a bump and a slope at the door.
We just heard the pre-recorded comments of Ames resident Shelley Jaspering, whose new home was built with some of the inclusive design principles that ISU architecture professor Dr. Arvid Osterberg is known for using and teaching his architecture students. And Dr. Osterberg is with us in the studio.
Dr. Osterberg, or Arvid,
yes.
This morning. Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to pass on to the listener about inclusive or design?
Yeah, well, I think it's a tough subject to try to cover in just a few minutes, but I think all citizens, all of us, need to be more aware of the sort of general principles, and then hold people responsible. All of us need to take more responsibility. Builders can do a better job. Community people can do a better job. Designers can do a better job. I think we all have to share in the responsibility. But with the thoughtfulness coming into it from the beginning, many of these things can be done. And it's so much cheaper to do it in the beginning than to come back later and try to make modifications. So it really starts with the initial planning. And of course, all public buildings, new public buildings, need to be done according to the minimum standards of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best way to do it or the most inclusive way to do it. So we need to think beyond the minimum standards in order to get things to really work as best as possible for the greatest number of people as possible. And that's really what inclusive design is all about.
And it's wonderful that you're kind of instilling that approach into the next generation of architects, because I think it'll take a while for that idea to filter down. But that I imagine that's one of the things they considered in giving you the humanitarian award, that it's not just the actual work that you do in design, but the idea of spreading this kind of approach and belief. Thank you, Professor Osterberg, for being with us in the studio today to discuss inclusive design, and congratulations again on being named Ames Humanitarian for 2015. We also thank Ames homeowner Shelley Jaspering for coming into KHOI earlier this week to share her experiences using inclusive design principles when she planned her unit in a new duplex on Duff Ave.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio on 89.1 Story City Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We would like to thank our guests. We were joined by Jean-Paul Chassan Cardenas, the State 4-H Youth Development Program Leader. We also were joined by Arvid Osterberg and Shelley Jaspering.
Local Talk was engineered by Rick Morrison. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Slip Sliding Away by Paul Simon. Local Talk is a production, a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible.
Your hosts for Local Talk today were Gail Seiler and Loris Olson. Remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of KHOI. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Dear KHOI listener, this is your station update. Every once in a while, we want to check in and give you an update about how KHOI is growing as a community organization.
This is what's new around here. For the past 2 months, various community members have been meeting with the KHOI Board of Directors and giving us feedback on how the station is doing and where people want us to go. They've been helping us as we look ahead, and together we are building a bigger vision.
These advisors have been discussing new ideas for programs, fundraising, and how to better connect KHOI with community in 2015.
We wish to express our heartfelt thanks to all who have served on this advisory group. It's been great to have you with us, and we are thrilled that many of you are staying on as advisors to develop these topics as volunteers and to carry out these ideas.
We always welcome community input at KHOI and invite you, the listener, to get involved with us. If you would like to give us feedback as well or join one of these committee efforts, please get in touch with us down here at KHOI. Our phone number is 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or email Joe Lynch, KHOI Board President, at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. That's onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. Or just come on down to 410 Douglas at the Ames Pantorium. You are always welcome. We welcome your input. This is Ursula Rudenberg, KHOI Station Manager.
And Joe Lynch, KHOI Board President, with your KHOI Station Update.
Thank you for listening.
If you're listening to KHOI 89.1 right now, we ask you to support this radio station. If we allow corporations to control our entire media landscape, then the people ultimately lose. These are public airwaves. They don't belong to CNN. They don't belong to MSNBC. They don't belong to Fox. No matter what anyone in power tells you, the airwaves in this country belong to the people. And it's radio stations like KHOI that are going to remind people, if you support this radio station, if you support independent media, if you support an independent voice at a time of increasing media consolidation, then we ask you to do everything you can to keep this station on the air. KHOI 89.1, Story City, Ames, Iowa.